You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. President Obama this morning announced his plan to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. Almost immediately, there was opposition, much of it partisan. Donald Trump, you might know, has said he opposes the president's plan to close Guantanamo. And this is one more example of the political divisiveness in our country. You might wonder how we even became a country. One country, that is, instead of many. Well, Donald Fraser has researched and written about this question. His new book is titled The Emergence of One American Nation. And we thought this was a timely conversation in light of the presidential race coming to the West. Donald's in the studio. Hello, welcome to the studio.
Good morning, Beth. Thank you for having me.
So your book starts with the colonial era, which is the early 1600s, and it moves forward. Is there a parallel to this latest example that I just cited of the president and his plan where national security is a component of the struggle?
There are many examples, but probably the best one falls outside of the period that I covered in my book. And it's during the period when John Adams is president of the United States. Washington has left office but negotiated what's known as the Jay Treaty, which the Republicans at that time, which was the party of Jefferson and the more liberal party, viewed as being too pro-British. And the French also viewed it as being pro-British and began what came to be known as the Quasi-War under the Adams administration. And in response, in part in response to what was going on with sort of a war setting and war fever, the Federalists, who were the party of Washington and Hamilton, implemented a series of measures known as the Alien and Sedition Act. The alien part of the act was to remove French people from the United States at that point in time. And the Sedition Act was to make it illegal to criticize the government. Rather surprising, given that we had, even at that time, the First Amendment was already in place. And it's one of those acts that occurred that I would equate to what happened with the Japanese during World War II, where they were put in concentration camps. During periods of fear, we tend to overreact to things, and we tend to do things that don't fit in with the best values of the United States and of what we are as Americans.
Did that battle extend over a long period of time, and how was some agreement or resolution either reached or enforced?
So the result of that was that in the election of 1800, ultimately Thomas Jefferson was elected president, and then he overturned the Alien and Sedition Act after he was elected. So that's how that one was resolved. But there are many other cases in American history where they were actually resolved through compromise and the two parties getting together and figuring out how to resolve things.
Let me go back to something basic. I was using the word country, and in your book you use the word nation, and in the introduction you write about nation and country. Do you see these words as having a difference, and if so, what?
It's sort of a technical difference. The word country is used in the political science field to denote a geographic area. Nation is meant to reflect a common sense that people have that they are part of one people, and so that they are Americans. In the early times, colonial period, through the Revolution, there was no sense of being an American. In fact, it was considered rather a pejorative. It was like being called a provincial, and it took many years, and finally the writing of the Constitution to really draw us in as one nation. And that's primarily what the book is about, is telling that story.
You do focus there, and you actually make the case that the partisan conflicts helped shape the Constitution, which ultimately shaped the nation. So that's an argument for the strife we're in the midst of right now.
We've always disagreed. We've always had fundamental disagreements. Now, the founders would have said that they were anti-party. Jefferson once wrote, "If I could not go to heaven but with a party, I would choose not to go at all." But the fact that they were anti-party didn't mean they had their own set of disagreements. Probably the most fundamental of the disagreements was whether we would be 13 separate colonies or states as we were after the Declaration, or whether we would be formed into one nation. And it was really, there were a small group of nationalists that finally led the movement towards nationhood. And fortunately for us sitting here today as Americans, it was led by none other than George Washington.
Let's go back, though, to the roots of the partisan differences and the emergence of the parties. So I think the question is, where did all the fighting begin?
There were two fundamental sort of points of view that the early colonists and then the early people had during that period. On the one side, there was a group of people that didn't want to replace the strong central government that the British had represented in the colonial period with another strong central government that would be located somewhere else other than their own home state, which is what they considered to be their country. So you had that, those people on one side. Sounds familiar, Beth, right?
Yeah,
isn't
it does.
That very much what we have today? And on the other side, what was pushing them together was the need to fight a war against the greatest military power that existed at that time, the British. There was no way that Massachusetts alone was going to be able to carry the day, or the Virginians. They needed all 13 of the colonies or states to be involved in the war. And so that sort of pushes them together. And then the people who end up fighting the war, the army, they're from all different states, so they begin to come to know each other and to develop more of a national sense. And that was the first group in the United States that developed a sense that they were something more than just Virginians or New Yorkers. They were, in fact, part of an American nation.
That little bit of history, though, and you write that a statesman would say, I am a Briton, or George Washington would say, I'm a Virginian, and they didn't categorize themselves in a broader sense. I think about the debates when the candidates were saying, well, I'm a governor. Well, I'm a senator. Well, I'm from the East. Well, I'm from the North. And that we still have those divided influences. But at some point, it became apparent to the leaders that the sum would be greater than the individual parts. Are we just not there yet, but working our way toward that? Or do we have unique circumstances with President Obama and what's happening with Congress?
I don't think there's anything new under the sun. What they were doing is what we're doing now. The missing ingredient, it seems to me today, is at some point you have to put aside your partisan differences and you have to govern the nation in the best interests of the public. And you have to reach some form of principled compromise in order to get there. And I'll give you just one example from the Constitutional Convention. The convention was split between small and large states. Small states were afraid if they formed into one nation and a stronger central government, they'd be gobbled up by the large states. And what they ultimately ended up compromising on, and it was a difficult compromise. When you read the book, you'll see how difficult it is for them to reach this compromise by the large states. But what they finally decide to do is to split the Senate, and that represents the states, and the House of Representatives represents the public at large through what's called proportional representation.
In terms of a history book, it is really easy to negotiate. I find it very readable, and it's amazing how applicable it is to the time we're living in right now. You're listening to Don Frazier. He is the author of the book we're discussing, which is titled The Emergence of One American Nation. If I go to the chapter that's titled We the People, there is a segment on the Electoral College and why the Electoral College. And it begins with these sentences. As we have seen, part of the framers' hesitancy about having the people directly elect the president came from their concern that no candidate would receive a majority. They could not foresee the role that political parties would play in the future, and many of them opposed parties. That no candidate would receive the majority. It's very interesting to think about that and how we have evolved the process to narrow down.
So you have to look at it from the perspective that they were living in areas that were widely divergent from each other culturally, politically. They were great distances between these people. And most people never left the area that they came from. So for someone in Virginia to have an understanding of what it was like to live in Massachusetts, they didn't have that. So there was no, we didn't have cell phones and televisions and like we're talking on radio today and the ability to communicate on a mass basis. And so that's part of the reason why they couldn't envision someone getting a national vote, because other than Washington and probably Franklin, no one else was known throughout all of the colonies. And so they couldn't envision that that would happen. And part of the reason that parties came about is in order to knit all of that together, to bring people from different areas together that were like-minded, had similar points of view, to organize opposition to what the government was doing. So the Federalists, as they're in power in the 1790s, Jefferson, who's actually a part of Washington's administration at this point, forms the Republican Party, which is the precursor of the Democratic Party today, because he doesn't like the policies of Alexander Hamilton. And so he begins to organize like-minded people, not only in Virginia and the South, but also in the North, that disagree with what the Federalists were trying to do.
So with what you're saying, I'm reminded that in the chapter titled The Failure of the First American Government, you do write, "We now live in a nation that is part Jeffersonian and part Hamiltonian. And from one side, the Jefferson side, we cherish liberty, equality, democracy, and the importance of the ability of the average person to fully participate. And then from the Hamilton side came the vision that America's economic future lay as a capitalist country." So connect the dots a little more directly to the 2016 presidential race. And what worked in resolving differences then that can work now?
That's a major question, I want to quote you something. This is a quote from a writer, L.P. Hartley, who wrote, "The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there." Mm. So it's often difficult to exactly get an analogy to current times with what was happening then. Let me give you a little bit more of an example. Jefferson was the liberal in the group, what we would consider the liberal of the group, the founder of the Democratic Party. If I were to tell you that he believed in states' rights and smaller government and a strict interpretation of the Constitution, you would think he was the conservative at that point in time. Hamilton, on the other side of the ledger, was the conservative in the group who believed in an expansive role for the central government. He would have probably completely eliminated the states if he could have had his way, and believed in a very broad interpretation of the Constitution. And so both men represent something in the future, right? Because we have both of those, only the sides have sort of flipped with in terms of how we look at things today versus how they looked at them then. And there's a whole bunch of historical forces that make up why those differences flipped over time. And some of them I explore in the book.
And it made for a great story on Broadway, too.
Hamilton has become quite a hit, and I can't wait for it to come to California.
Well, I don't know. It's so popular in New York. I think it is 2 years or something before you can get a ticket. All right. Where is your book available right now?
So the book is available locally in Roseville. I'm from Roseville, and it's available in the Almost Perfect bookstore there, also in the St. Vincent de Paul thrift store. It's available downtown at the Avid Reader at Tower, and up in the foothills at the bookseller in Grass Valley. And finally, it's available online both as a printed book and an ebook on Amazon and Barnes & Noble's websites.
Oh, you've got it down. Well, it's a great companion to the campaign right now, and anyone that's interested in history might want it on their shelf. Don, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Beth.
Very timely conversation. Don Fraser, and again, his book is The Emergence of One American Nation. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio.